Well, we're glad to see that everybody made it here safely for our first case, at least, and that we have come up with some resolution regarding oral argument this morning. If our clerk will please announce counsel. Thank you. All right, Mr. Cooper, I believe you're going first.
May it please the court, in the oral argument today, I'm not going to furnish or focus on the expert issues because of the limited time. I think they are addressed adequately in both the briefs, but rather I'd like to focus on two issues that I think lend themselves more to the time that we have today. The first one concerns the charge and the failure of the trial judge to submit two inferential rebuttal issues. One, unavoidable accident. The second was new and independent cause. Now, in the case at hand, Dr. Chinduri objected to the omission of both of those issues. And we know from the Supreme Court that the purpose of those instructions is to inform the jury that you don't have to place the blame on a party to the lawsuit, that sometimes things happen and it's not the fault of either party to the lawsuit. Now, this court, at the end of last year in Young versus Thota, addressed the issue of when in a medical malpractice case it was appropriate to submit unavoidable accident as well as new and independent cause. Originally in this case, there was argument from Appley that it had to be a non-human event, but I think this court in Young versus Thota said that the event that is, for example, an unavoidable accident can be a condition of the human body. And in Young versus Thota, this court said that as long as it's something that was not caused by the conduct of a party, it may be appropriate for an unavoidable accident. And in Young versus Thota, there was two allegations. One was that the clot was caused by a puncture site where they did the laparoscopic. And the other thing was that it was just caused by a disease process. And here, the court, when they looked at it, they said whether or not it was caused by a human condition, if it was caused by a human condition, then, in fact, unavoidable accident would be appropriate. So the question in this case was whether or not there was some human condition that perhaps caused the death of Ms. Cunningham that wasn't the result of the negligence of either parties. Our Supreme Court, under standard of review, has said if it's raised by the evidence, that is, an inferential rebuttal, doesn't have to be pleaded. Moulton versus Alamo Ambulance says it doesn't have to be pleaded. It was in this case. But if it's raised by the evidence, then it's error not to submit it. Now, we look at the evidence in this case, and the question was whether or not there was some evidence that Ms. Cunningham died from a condition that was not the result of human negligence. There was testimony from Dr. Kelly that Mrs. Cunningham died from a DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulopathy. He testified, that's at page 27, reporter's record 127, that a DIC is a specific complication of pneumonia and that the medical community doesn't know what causes DICs or why they happen. 27, reporter's record at 127. Dr. Chinduri, he testified that the DIC was the cause of her strokes that led to her death. Volume 30, reporter's record, page 192. And finally, Dr. Uzunkama testified that the DIC led to multi-organ failure, which caused Pat Cunningham's death. Volume 23 of the reporter's record, 206-07. So we had evidence from at least three different experts that you had this condition, that nobody knows what causes it. It can be caused not from the fault of anybody, and we believe as a result that raised the issue of unavoidable accident, which would require its submission. Now, the other inferential rebuttal that we've issue that we've raised is new and independent cause. And again, defendants in this case objected to the lack of inclusion in the definition of proximate cause of new and independent cause. And this court in Young versus Thota also addressed the application of new and independent cause in the medical malpractice context. Now, in Young versus Thota, this court said in that case it was not appropriate because it was foreseeable based upon the testimony in that case that you could, from this puncture, that you could get this clots form and break loose. And because it was foreseeable in that case, and also because there was some issue about whether or not the plaintiff's conduct and not coming back to the hospital, it was caused by one of the parties to the lawsuit, this court said it wasn't appropriate. Now, in this case, neither one of those factors are present. Dr. Kelly said that we don't know why DICs happen. Again, page 127 of volume 27 of the reporter's record. Dr. Uzunkama on the foreseeability said no one could have foreseen the DICs in this case. Volume 23 of the reporter's record, page 127. And finally, Dr. Samuels testified that what happened to Pat was not reasonably foreseeable to Dr. Chinduri. And that's at volume 33 of the reporter's record, pages 80 through 81. So we had at least three different witnesses testify that this condition was not foreseeable and was not the result of human negligence. And so we believe that based upon what this court said in Young versus Thota, that it was appropriate for the trial court to have submitted new and independent cause. Now, the next step is, okay, was it harmful error for the trial court not to submit these two inferential rebuttals? Again, you go back to the Dillard case from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says that the primary purpose of inferential rebuttal instructions is to inform the jury that they don't have to place the blame on somebody in the lawsuit. Sometimes things just happen, and it's not the result of the fault of anyone who is a party to the lawsuit. We believe in this case the jury should have been advised that no one, that they did not have to place the blame on anybody as far as the death of Pat Cunningham. The charge in this case was the standard PJC charge, whose negligence, if any, do you find caused? There was one question, death. The other question was the injuries. But in the Dillard case, the Supreme Court said that by instructing the jury in that format, that there is at least a potential implication in this phraseology, whose negligence, if any, that the occurrence was caused by someone's negligence. And in Dillard, the court said that's the reason we have the inferential rebuttal. There was a big push in Dillard to try to eliminate inferential rebuttals, and the court rejected that. And they said, in part, it's based upon the way we submit negligence questions in Texas. Now, this case was hotly contested. It lasted a very long time. The issue of new and independent cause was mentioned by counsel, for example, in Vordire, Volume 3, Reporter's Record 185. It was mentioned in Opening 5, Volume Reporter's Record number 19. And we believe, certainly the jury could have believed, well, defense counsel had mentioned the fact that it could be nobody's fault. New and independent cause, unavoidable accident, and the fact that it's not in the charge means the judge disagreed with defense counsel because it's not there. So we believe there was harmful error and that it was error for the trial court not to submit these two inferential rebuttal issues because they were clearly raised by the evidence. The second issue I want to raise in the brief time I have left is the juror notes. This is a hot issue in Texas law, the question of whether or not they should be allowed to go back to the jury room. There's no question jurors should be allowed to take notes, but the question is, should they go back to the jury room? We'd point out to the court that Senate Bill 445, introduced by Senator Wentworth, currently is seeking to regulate the issue of juror notes, taking them, going back to the jury room. In the current version of Senate Bill 445, if it is passed, the notes would not be allowed to go back to the jury room for several reasons. One is we believe it's an outside influence. The notes supplant the role of the court reporter. The notes may be inaccurate. Sometimes people hear things that that are inaccurate. Sometimes people don't hear things. My wife always says, I don't hear what she says, and sometimes I think people just hear things they want to hear and don't hear other things. I think the fact that someone may have written it down would tend to cause other jurors to give it more weight. Also, we know that the notes may contain material that's not in evidence. In this case, if you look at five reporters' record 35, 36, and 48, in the opening statement, there's mention of the juror taking notes, and 35, reporters' record 67, it's mentioned they're taking notes during closing argument, which are not evidence.
Mr. Cooper, are you just complaining about the notes going back at the conclusion of the evidence or during the entire trial proceeding?
Our complaint is that the notes went back during deliberations.
Okay.
And then the other thing is our not getting access to the notes, so it's under TRAP Rule 44.1A2, it sort of makes it impossible for us to show that there was or was not error.
Because the trial court sealed them.
Sealed them, and we have not been afforded access.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, may I ask one question going back to your new and independent cause and unavoidable accident? Are there any cases that you're aware of where a case, a judgment has actually been reversed for failure to submit an inferential rebuttal
sure.
instruction?
Galveston Railway versus Washington, which is a recently cited by the Supreme, it's a Supreme Court case that was recently decided or cited by the Supreme Court in Due versus Crown Derrick in 2006. That court held that it was error to submit or fail to submit unavoidable accident in that particular case. There's other ones regarding pre-existing condition, but that's one of the more recent ones. In that case, it's an old case, 1901, but it was recently cited with approval by the Supreme Court in Due versus Crown Derrick in 2006.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Ms. Youngblood.
May it please the court. Two definitive results need to come from this appeal. One, how do you submit a wrongful death and survival claim to the jury with just one liability question as to wrongful death or with two liability questions, one for wrongful death, one for survival? And two, how specific or must a Rule 702 reliability objection be in order to preserve error? Can an objection that says, we object to everything regarding causation that any of your experts might say meet the specificity requirements. As to that second point, we emphasize that we do not concede that there was any error in the expert challenges rulings made by Judge Wade. We think he got it right. But we also point out that error was waived, and that would prevent this court from the need to examine this entire It's a 10,000-page record. Also, we ask the court to keep in mind Dr. Chinduri's thorazine-induced hypotension, which was a cause of Ms. Pat Cunningham's death, which was never the subject of any reliability challenge, and the evidence of which was so solid that it was not even raised as an issue in this appeal. Now, these two issues are intertwined, and they all go under the heading of preservation of error under TRAP 33.1, where a party has to make the trial court sufficiently aware of the complaint unless the circumstances are obvious. So timeliness and specificity is the key. This notion, I don't know where it came from, a false notion that in a wrongful death case, you're only entitled, the plaintiff's only entitled to an issue, a liability question as to wrongful death. I don't know where it came from, but it has spread like kudzu throughout this jurisdiction, and I submit it is time for it to be eradicated, pulled out by its roots. This court in Young versus Thoda got close to that and said as much, that they're two separate issues. But I think more is needed, more definitive statement is needed, because we've been kicking this can down the road since Pack versus Crossroads. This is a fundamental issue, and it is very simple how you submit these things. It's 1, 2, 3, wrongful death cause of action. You have liability, apportionment, damages. Survival cause of action, liability, apportionment, damages. There, you're done. No more complaints about how it was submitted. I'd like to talk about how we preserved error on this issue. We complied with Rule 278 and all the affiliated rules. We made a written request for it to be submitted just that way. And it was clear that Judge Wade understood the complaint we were making. That's on the record. You can find this exchange at tab E in the plaintiff's brief against Dr. Haruna. The Judge Wade said on the record that if I don't submit it this way with the plaintiff's two liability questions, you will be back here. Now, for whatever reason, he didn't submit it. We got a draft of the court's argument, a charge, that did have the plaintiff's requested submission, the two liability questions. But on the day of the charge, 10 minutes before, we were handed another one, which only had one. You only had got the survival claim conditional on a no answer to the wrongful death claim. With respect to Dr. Haruna, that meant since the jury did not find that he had caused Pat's death, we didn't get a survival question against him. We did against Dr. Chinduri because the jury found he had caused her death.
Well, what, if you can do so briefly, injuries do you claim Pat suffered herself that would be the basis of a survival claim that did not result in her death?
The trigeminal neuralgia, causing her to eat, the worst pain known to man, causing her to eat, placing oxygen mask, even something called a BiPAP.
Oh, sorry, I mean that would be the basis for your suit, that was injuries that would have been caused by the doctors, the defendants.
Yes. If Pat had survived and walked out of the hospital, she would have had a right to complain about being subjected to that torture and having to breathe 50 times a minute just to stay alive, turning blue, almost stopping breathing, the torment, the anxiety of that. She had a lot, being hunger, bringing trays of food that she can't eat and going without feeding of any substance for almost 2 weeks in the hospital. If she had survived, she had a lot to complain about. And that would have been the basis of her survival claim. If I answered.
That's right. Thank you.
Can you recall then what precipitated the change in the trial court's charge? Were there objections between the charge that you had basically approved and then the change charge that came out a few minutes before it was going to be submitted to the jury?
None told to us, none told to me. And of course, this was what was talked. That what was given was the defendants, Dr. Chinduri's and Haruna's request. This is what the Supreme Court in Payne, the State Department of Highway, said. It's the reason why you don't get overly technical and legalistic at this point, coming as it does at the end of a trial. We had a 3-month trial, and getting ready to say the last words you're going to the jury, and then being given this. Well, you know, there's something that maybe I didn't pick up on. Nobody tries a perfect case. No judge and no trial lawyer tries a perfect case. And maybe this is one of the mistakes I made when I argued the charge. I did not specifically point out you have conditioned the survival claim on certain answers to the wrongful death claim. But that was the exact reason why Payne said you don't get legalistic. It's not that you must request a submission and make an objection. It's a request or objection. Supreme Court reemphasized that in Alanis, and in the course of, case of Harry versus University of Texas System, cited in our brief, that was the exact issue that the plaintiff's attorney had not pointed out, that the conditional submission was kept the jury from getting where it needed to go because they had made a full request for the way it should have been done. This is broad form submission the way we want it. The way the opposition wanted is no submission at all. These are not, we shouldn't be forced to an election. The trial court tried to have us make an election, just give up on your wrongful death and then you can get your survival. We couldn't agree to that. These are not mutually exclusive claims. The way to submit it, I think, is pretty clear.
Well,
now,
can I ask a question?
Of course.
I think you've indicated this earlier, but hasn't the Supreme Court, in so many words, said that the injuries must arise out of the death that is the basis of the wrongful death suit?
I must disagree, Your Honor. I do not agree. I think I can't understand the logic in that. Why should someone, if she'd survived, she could have sued for this, but because she died, she can't sue for it unless it comes out. I don't see that anywhere in the law or in logic. So if there's a case out there that says that, I'm unaware of it, and I would respectfully disagree with it. As to Dr. Chinduri's reliability challenges, in his reply brief, he pretty much concedes these weren't specific, but says they don't need to be, citing Guadalupe versus Kraft. But that case said it was clear from the context. Here we have this was not done in good faith. I don't believe the very issue that the Judge Wade asked him on the record, what's your objection? I think it's just as clear Judge Wade didn't understand their objection as it was clear that he did understand our objection. But the defendants, Dr. Chinduri, chose to be nonspecific. This was his trial strategy. In response to Judge Wade's question, he said, well, that's her problem. She doesn't know her case. She and her, meaning me, personally, and they refused to be specific. And they 3-month trial, they sat there, never once came through with an objection. All the evidence came through. They didn't stand up and object. They did voir dire or witnesses, but what did they do after they finished their voir dire? They didn't object. They didn't ask for a ruling. They didn't get a ruling. That was their strategy, trial and appeal by ambush. And you can read in it, there's a bit of glee comes through, like they're sticking it to the plaintiff. Well, and of course, in a way they are, but they're sticking it to Judge Wade. They're sticking it to the jury. They're sticking it to this court and maybe even their own client when all of these things, they wait to appeal to finally get specific. I don't know what rule there needs to be, but I think the rule needs to come out of this case, not for every case, but in this case, these global drive-by objections do not preserve error. And Dr. Chinduri waived error in two other ways. This evidence, the same or similar evidence, came in time and time again, even by him. He asked these type of questions. He elicited this type of testimony, and he waived the error. Now, in Justice Brister, if you review the record, I think you will see that the reliability requirement was met, even under the inapplicable but very strict Havner toxic tort test. But I'm hoping you won't have to wade through all that. Justice Brister, when he was Chief Justice of the 14th Court of Appeals in Exxon versus Makovsky, said that you need to object during trial. Now, I know that there are other cases that say you don't if you object to pretrial, but I think given where Justice Brister is now, his opinion has some a degree of weight. And in this case, I see it demonstrates why you do need to object during trial. Dr. Chinduri did not ask for a running objection. He did not object during trial. when multiple witnesses came in. Many of these witnesses were never objected to. And then the absence of the survival question has implications for not just Dr. Haruna, but Dr. Chinduri. Dr. Chinduri got what he asked for, the submission he asked for. Now he assumes, without even addressing it, that if the wrongful death part of the case is reversed, then he gets to retry the whole case. And I say that's not true. That would not be true if we had a liability question for survival, and it shouldn't be true because the only reason we don't have a liability question for survival is because Dr. Chinduri got and asked for his submission, which omitted it. That falls under the doctrine of invited error, that when you ask for something and you get it, you cannot seek to get an advantage because of what you asked to be excluded was. So as to the new and independent cause, I think Eurista is the pertinent case, which basically, Bed Bath & Beyond case, which basically says it's really not a reversible error. The complaints on appeal do not comport to the complaints at trial. At trial, they told Judge Wade it was the strokes that was the new and independent cause. Now they say DIC. Oh, they say, well, it's all the same thing. No, it's not. Strokes is not DIC. And if it were, why didn't they stick with the strokes during appeal? They made the shift because they thought they could make a better argument. But why do you... You can't judge Judge Wade's decision whether he abused his discretion by not answering a question or ruling on an objection or a submission that he was never asked. You must go not by what's in the brief of Dr. Chinduri, but what Judge Wade, before you can say he called it wrong, you have to look at what he was looked at and what he was given to look at. And... I know that in FOTA there was a recognition of medical condition. I think that was dicta. I think it was unfortunate. I would ask this court to correct that and go back to James v. Claus and a whole host of other cases from this court that says a medical condition cannot be a new and independent cause or an unavoidable occurrence. That's just part and parcel of disproving the causation element of the plaintiff's negligence case, but it is not new and independent. Dr. Chinduri did not meet his burden to show under Wigglesworth versus Peoples and other decisions of this court that his negligence had come to rest, and this was something new that came in after he had negligence had ceased. So I would ask the court to affirm this case as to Dr. Chinduri and reverse and remand as to Dr. Haruna for a new trial on the issue of Pat Cunningham's survival claims.
Another question regarding that. Didn't the jury's finding of damages to Pat, the $1.4 million, wasn't that her survival damages that they found and awarded against Dr. Chinduri?
It was the survival damages that they found were caused by the defendants that caused her wrongful death. They did not find her survival damages that was caused by Dr. Haruna. They weren't asked. So if they think that there was something independent and discreet, for example, Dr. Haruna was on-call physician. He never came to the hospital during this terrible crisis, and he ordered by phone the placing the BiPAP on her, which caused her tremendous pain. If the jury found, well, that's Dr. Haruna's call, what he caused then, and I'm just using an example that comes off my head, that would be a survival damage that would be in addition and separate from whatever the wrongful death defendants were found to have caused her.
Well, how would you try the case against Haruna and limit the jury to damages that they hadn't already awarded against Dr.
Chinduri. I think that there, you just try the case. And if that's a problem, I'm sorry, but it's not my problem. I didn't cause it. Dr. Haruna asked for it. Dr. Chanduri asked for it. But I don't think there's a finite amount of money that say, well, that's her damages. You can't get more. That's the damages that the jury found caused by these other defendants, and it's totally separate from what you would cause here. And I'm not asking for a retrial of Dr. Haruna's wrongful death case. I think we're done. They are separable. I think he had his day. We had his day. That's done. But this is separate. It's independent. It was never allowed to be considered, and it should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Youngblood. Now, Mr. Rios. And you're here for Dr. Haruna, correct?
Yes.
All right.
May it please the court, counsel. Briefly, facts of this case, I feel boiled down to the fact that in this case, Ms. Cunningham suffered from what everyone has agreed was a very painful condition, trigeminal neuralgia. She was admitted to the hospital for that condition. In fact, plaintiff's experts testified it was a condition that made you wish you were dead. After being in the hospital for 10 days, Dr. Haruna was the on-call physician for Dr. Azukama. Dr. Azukama was the pulmonologist who had been consulted by Mrs. Cunningham's physician, Dr. Chanduri, to help look at this case. He was involved in her care from June 2nd, 2003, 11 p.m., until June 3rd, 2003, at about 3:10 a.m. Got a total of about 4 hours, 10 minutes. He issued 3 orders during that time frame. Now, when we talk about the charge, one of the things that I think has not been addressed in the brief of the appellants is a lack of evidence of injury. We pointed out in our brief that the experts in this case, there were two presented by the plaintiff. There was a Dr. Narden, Alan Narden, who had been ruled by the court as not qualified to testify regarding the standard of care of a pulmonologist. But even Dr. Narden, when he talked about this case, referenced it as a cascade of effects, a series of dominoes. He indicated that he could not extract one issue that, if done differently, would have given a different result. In fact, it was his opinion that no one could take one act or omission and say it could have produced a different outcome. He couldn't tease it away. Now, Dr. Varon, V-A-R-O-N, he was another of the plaintiff's experts. He came in and also likened her condition to a series of events, said not just one person's fault, everyone's care was needed to bring her death. Now, the reason that's important is because even the appellant in her brief says that the plaintiffs maintained that Dr. Haruna's negligence pushed Mrs. Cunningham over the edge, although the jury disagreed. The theory that they went under was one of wrongful death. There was no evidence presented in the form of expert testimony that there was a separate and distinct injury which resulted from that 4 or so hours of care given by Dr. Haruna to Mrs. Cunningham to warrant this separate survival issue. The case law and the rules indicate you've got to have pleading, sufficient evidence, in order to get this issue before a jury. The pleading was for survival damages. It did not plead a specific injury by Dr. Haruna with regards to Mrs. Cunningham. We don't believe that the evidence was sufficient to warrant that issue being submitted. Now, when it came right down to it and the court's charge was presented, the court took a tack of giving a wrongful death question, but then he took damages and he included survival damages. I think those are very clear within the charge, the language of the charge on question 4, where he indicated or asked the jury to award damages as a result of the injuries in question before her death. He clearly made that question something outlined as survival damages. Now, he then came back and had limiting language. After that series of questions, After question 7, he asked, if you answered no as to everybody on question 1, then go ahead and answer question 8, which was a pure survival question about injuries before her death. But if you did answer anybody, then don't answer question 8. That's a real clear charge that required an objection. That was a charge that was not submitted in that form. In fact, it's our position that the appellant never submitted a charge in the form in which she now argues she should have gotten. But more importantly, that she didn't object to that limiting language. She didn't object to that instruction, which changed the face of the charge. And we feel that she had that obligation to do that, to allow Judge Wade to determine whether or not he was making a mistake or not, whether the evidence warranted the submission. But that wasn't done. Under Rule 274, she was supposed to distinctly outline for the court the objectionable matter and the grounds of the objection. That wasn't done. While she did object to other portions of the charge, and that's clearly outlined, this was not something she objected to. It's our position because she didn't, that was waived. Now, she wants to say, because I submitted the form, or I submitted my charge in substantial clerk form, I didn't have to. But that doesn't make sense because she did make other objections. She did object to other things in the charge. If the position is, I don't have to because I'm protected, I've done what I needed to do, then why do you do that? Because that's not the way it's done. Now, there are cases that say you apply this in a common sense manner. Well, the common sense in this case would tell you, if you looked at this charge and that limiting language was very clear, there was no confusion as to what it was doing, that's something that should have been objected to and was not. Looking at the totality of the circumstances in this case, we feel that the objection was waived, was not preserved. We feel that there was a lack of evidence to support a submission of an injury question or survival because there simply was not the sufficient pleading and, more importantly, sufficient expert testimony in a medical malpractice case to warrant that submission. And looking at totality, when you look at the amount of time we're talking about, 4 hours and 10 minutes as an on-call physician, 10th day into the stay, it seems very unlikely that that even occurred. The fact that she had this condition and it was painful, pain is not injury. Those two are not the same thing. She was suffering from pain. That's what brought her into the hospital. The fact that she continued to suffer pain was not a distinguished or separate injury caused by Dr. Haruna. Anything they did to her face was going to be painful. Putting on a BiPAP mask was going to be painful. Her eating was painful. Wind blowing on her face was painful. But pain is not injury. And we feel that in this case, it's a very simple issue. Again, it was waived, insufficient evidence to support that submission.
Thank you, Mr. Rios. Ms. Youngblood?
Pain is not injury? Well, of course it is. Physical pain and mental anguish are the damages that's commonly sought. I don't get that. That the pleadings weren't sufficient. Reading from my reply brief, all these issues are covered in my reply brief to Dr. Haruna. Dr. Haruna did not specially accept the pleadings are liberally construed in plaintiff's favor, satisfies any pleading requirement. We pled that Dr. Haruna caused damages to Patricia, including harm to her health, physical pain and suffering, mental anguish, physical impairment, disfigurement, and medical expenses, and that pursuant to Texas Survival Statute, recovery was sought for all damages for which Pat could have recovered had she lived. Oh, yes, it was pleaded. If it wasn't, it was tried by consent. But, yes, it was pleaded. Yes, and there was evidence. Just 4 hours? 4 hours of pure hell. This was the time when the defense doctor said, yes, she needed to be intubated early on, and if she did, she was going to poop out. That's their term. And this is the night that she finally, after having to breathe 50 times a minute just to compensate for her body's lack of oxygen, she did poop out. And during those 4 minutes, she went down and suffered, struggling to breathe. Dr. Verone called it the big, longest stress test I have ever seen. This woman was remarkable that she could have held out as long as she did. Yes, she suffered. The fact that they could not link that we said the jury disagreed with the death, yes, that's the point. We give up on the death thing. The doctors apparently didn't connect Dr. Haruna's action to her death sufficiently to satisfy the jury. That's why we're not asking for a retrial on the death case. But on the Harry case, it's exactly what we said about the conditional submission. It is exactly what, well, it was clear, it was plain, well, they weren't there. I was there after 3 months of living in the residence inn on South University trying this case, you know, just by myself and my husband, who wasn't even a lawyer at the time, and we've got the jury fixing to come in saying a two-hour submission and got all that in my head. I missed to say, point that out, but that's not the issue. Judge Wade knew. He knew what the complaint was, and for his own reasons, which maybe I'll ask him sometime, but we don't know, he just changed his mind overnight. And I did the best I could to argue the best I could, but Judge Wade knew the complaint, and he did not submit it as requested. If no more questions, then I'll ask the court again to affirm the case against Dr. Chinduri and to reverse and remand the survival case against Dr. Haruna for a new trial.
Thank you, Ms. Youngblood. Mr. Cooper?
3 points I'd like to cover in rebuttal. First off, whether or not Dr. Chinduri waived his objection regarding the expert's qualifications, reliability. There were full Daubert hearings on each of these experts. There were rulings on the record with respect to these. The Supreme Court in Ellis versus Maritime has held that if you go through that and you have a Daubert hearing and the court makes the ruling, you don't have to go back once they're admitted and once the evidence is offered in front of the jury and remake the same objections. The all the times where the objections were made are pages 3 through 4 or 3 through 5 of a reply brief. Second, Ms. Youngblood says, well, this is the first time we've really raised the DIC issues. We were talking about strokes in the trial court. Again, I would refer you to our briefs, volume 27, our reporter's record 127, Dr. Kelly's question about DICs. Volume 30, page reporter's record, page 192, Dr. Chinduri is questioned about DICs. Volume 23, reporter's record 206 to 07, Dr. Ezenkama is questioned about DICs. This is not the first time. It was raised extensively during the trial court. Lastly, whether or not we ought to have unavoidable accident or new and independent cause in medical malpractice cases, with all due respect to counsel, I mean, this court has said it's appropriate. The Dallas Court of Appeals in Banks versus Columbia Hospital has held that it's appropriate. The Pattern Jury Committee, when they put together the PJC and Section 50 dealing with medical malpractice cases, saw fit to include it. So I believe that it is appropriate because, again, the whole issue, as the Supreme Court talked about in Dillard, is you to tell the jury that they don't have to find somebody negligent, that as things can happen due to nobody's fault. And I think that's particularly appropriate in the medical malpractice arena. Sometimes people get sick. Sometimes people die through no fault of any doctor or through no fault of any hospital. It's their time. God has decided that it's their time to go, and there's nobody's fault. So I believe that particularly with respect to medical malpractice cases, these two inferential rebuttals are appropriate and should be given. In conclusion, we'd ask that the trial court judgment be reversed and rendered, or in the alternative, that the case be remanded back for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. All right, counsel, your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments today, and we appreciate your briefing in this matter. You are excused.